morning, everybody. This is the Berean class. And if you're visiting with us, welcome. We've got a special event today. Fred Brooks is going to lead a discussion on computer technology and how it influences the gospel. Is that close enough?
Or vice versa.
Okay, so I'm going to let him... I'm going to let him introduce the panel when that
man
comes.
Good morning. Our panel is Hollins Williams, D. Parsons, Barry Housel. And we're going to talk a little bit to start with. I've asked each one to talk about 5 minutes. And I'll talk 5 minutes to sort of set the context. But we're hoping to get, in spite of the layout of this room, some good participation from the audience.
So when you ask a question, stand up and talk loud.
And if I'm not loud enough, or if any of the panelists are not loud enough, hold up your hand, and we won't make you ask a question. I want to first remark on the nature of the computer and network revolution, and what's it changing? Information access. You have the combination of the Library of Congress and the Vatican Library at your fingertips. Communication. Creation, writing, art, music, design, manufacturing has really changed, and it's going to change some more. Control of machines, you know. The only reason you can mess up somebody's machines in Iran is because their machines are computer controlled. Analysis, studying to see what the numbers mean or what words mean or what images mean or even doing face recognition in images. Record keeping. Simulation. The business I'm in is making virtual experiences, principally for training. And finally, entertainment. Well, it's a societal revolution, and that I think is probably as much of our theme this morning as the question of how to use the technology to communicate the gospel. We can look back, but we can't turn back. And this will affect, I had one more remark, and that is, what it did, hasn't changed is it hasn't really changed transportation. It's incidentally changed transportation, but not essentially. That was changed by the automobile. And it hasn't really changed agriculture. That was changed by the tractor. When I was a boy, there were people still working 40 acres with a mule. And that was true in the 50s, even. And now a person works 1,000 acres with a tractor or combine that may cost $250,000. Now, so those are big revolutions like the Industrial Revolution, and the effect of each of these revolutions has been societal. So transportation really changed the way we organize cities. The tractor has displaced more people from the country to the urban than the computer will ever displace from one place to another. And maybe cost more jobs. Used to be one out of every two Americans was making food for the other one. And now it's 2% of all Americans are busy farming and making food. So, now, question, is this just the foretaste of what's coming? And I think any honest answer would be interested in your opinions on that. My guess is, I can't tell you what it's going to be, but I can tell you that it's going to be. And now the question that I hope we'll talk some about is the Christian response to this revolution any different from a moral, secular response? And if so, how? As we touch on these issues. And so here are some other kind of questions we can talk about. And Holly, let me get you to go first.
The way I was approaching this is how technology, particularly computers, have affected my life and my faith. Okay, because I just went to grad school at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. Okay, and Dr. Brooks is one of my professors there. And I was a Christian, was not a Christian though. And Liv's shaking her head, no. I'm sure both Dr. Brooks and Liv were praying for me occasionally while I was there. Yeah. And so I didn't become a Christian, so I moved to California, of all places. And this was in 1984. And at that time, I really had a great hunger for the Bible. had then were rather limited. I mean, I had radio. I could go and rent cassette tapes from the local Christian store. And of course, my local church is very strong. But it really wasn't the same as it is now. Okay? So you fast forward 30 years, and what changes have I seen and have been really positive for me? Well, first of all, you know, there's the classes that I have available to me now are not limited to local classes. I've taken Skype-like classes from Grace College of Divinity in Fayetteville, online courses from them as well. Currently, I'm taking courses from Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary, and two of my courses actually met here, but only, you know, a couple of days. It's not like graduate school where we had daily interaction with the students and professors and so on. So all these, there are a whole lot more opportunities for me to grow my faith in relation to other people and study the Word and some great teaching available. Of course, you know, the internet has made available sermons from a great variety of pastors. You know, get apps on your iPad to listen to Rabbi Zacharias or somebody. There's lots and lots of different resources that weren't there. Other thing that I'm part of, years ago, I don't know how many of you know this from Bill Fuller, but he was my pastor at the South Durham Bible Church for a long time. And I'm still related, you know, we still have a relationship with him. He's now living in Virginia, but he has this ministry called Strategic Impact. And I'm on his board of directors, and we're able to communicate and make that his ministry known to a wide variety of people because of things like the internet and social media. And this tremendous change, and the only negative thing has been for me, I think, is that the student-student relationships are not as strong as they used to be. For example, when I go to take these classes at Gordon Conwell, I see students, and one semester I'll see them 6 days. Okay? And you just don't get the chance to know them very well and continue relationships. And yeah, you can do email, but they're scattered all over the place. You know, there's some in Virginia, there's some in South Carolina, different parts of North Carolina. So it's just, I don't have the daily interaction, building friendships with them, which is something I really miss. So I think that's the only real negative. But in general, I found, yes, the internet and it has a lot of things that aren't good. And they're, you know, it's not perfect, but I've been able to take advantage of it to build my faith, to grow in a relationship with others. And so I feel very fortunate to live this time. Right.
All right.
About 5 years ago, I decided to start a blog and to talk about issues in evangelical Christianity. And I had this idea that maybe I'd get a nice little small group of people together and we could, you know, exchange back and forth with one another.
Hey, if you step a foot to the left, light won't be any fixed.
Thank you. And what happened was startling to me. At first, I started off as an anonymous blogger, and people started coming on and telling me their stories that happened to them in the church. And they were some of them were terrible stories. Families whose children had been abused and were marginalized, whose pastors didn't listen to them. Other people who had questions about pain and suffering and were told they asked too many questions. And I became concerned that this was going on, so I decided to come out with my name and my friend who does it with me. And we have found that anonymity allows people safety to discuss the things that truly hurt them. And as time has gone on, our blog has gotten to the point where I can't keep up with it. I am hundreds of emails behind. And I feel very guilty almost every day because people share difficult stories with me. For those of you who think that computers do not generate community, I'm going to tell you two very quick stories to disabuse you of that notion. A man showed up on my blog, angry, walked away from the church, foul-mouthed, awful. But I sensed something in his spirit that he was speaking. And so he works for the Department of Defense, and he and I began a conversation, and he was doing this with another blog called The Internet Monk. And as time went on, he started coming around. And he became very sick and landed in a hospital in D.C. Bill said, go up. He was in the ICU. Go up. Make sure he's okay. He isn't married. And so I went up, and his hospital room was being filled with chocolates, balloons, flowers from the internet community from all over the country. Several pastors came to his room. They were sent by people in the internet community. And this man said, we did church in that room. And in November, Bill and I were privileged to go up to D.C. to watch him be baptized in his church. And he is about to tell his story about forgiveness, and it's going to floor you. He went back to 140 people in his life and asked for forgiveness. Story number one. Story number two, a woman wrote me and said that she followed my blog in our discussions and that she was at the McMurdo station in Antarctica. I wrote it back. I said, if that's true, this better be true because I will be really mad if you're not. And, in fact, it was true. And I wrote a blog post that included part of her story, which I called The Really Frozen Chosen. And last summer, she goes off the ice, as she puts it, and she works as a park ranger for a few months. And I had a chance to spend the night with her up at the Smoky Mountains. And a group of park rangers came to her house, and we fellowshiped. She introduced me to these rangers, this you know, crazy Christian blogger. And I had a chance to talk to people I never would have talked to. So what I'm saying is that you can have community. You can reach out. The computer is a wonderful way to reach out to people. My problem is, how do I manage this? I'm having a very difficult time. So you started something, Fred, but I don't know how I'm going to handle what you started.
I didn't start it. I was merely along the road. Al Gore came to our laboratory one day. He was coming through. He did not make that claim there.
What's the name of your blog?
The name of my blog is, and I'm going to warn you, I talk about controversial subjects, as you can well imagine when you're talking child sex abuse and so forth. It's called the Wartburg Watch, and it's named after the castle that Martin Luther hid in and finished his translation of the New Testament that was then published on the Gutenberg Press, the internet of that day.
It is a great blog, I'll just say. I read it every day.
Barry?
Yeah, I entered the computer business in college when I was trying to master Fortran.
You get into shade too.
And I was a mechanical engineering major, and I hired into IBM, and they gave me the assignment to debug these mechanical design programs, and the code was terrible. I ended up learning enough to rewrite most of it, and I got into the computer science end of things and ended up going to Stanford and then later to Purdue to get my PhD. But the thing that struck me in all these years is the huge acceleration of how programming and so on is learning is going on. I mean, you can look at my tenure in California when I was going to Stanford, and the horror on my face when I dropped a box of cards. And fortunately, they had the statements were printed on the cards, but you know, they're all over. So my wife and I spent a couple of hours. And then after that, you get to pass this big box through a window and wait for an hour to get an output.
Right.
And now, going from that to a Harvard student, and a, you know, in a semester or two, Mark Zuckerberg ends up creating Facebook. You know, writing, because Lord knows he's a better programmer than I ever would, but I mean, just the amount of acceleration. So, anyway, so when I was thinking about this topic, I sort of broke it down into kingdom, family, and community. And I really appreciated the talk. My son-in-law is a Christian counselor, and he's having to deal with sexual abuse and all that stuff. Oh, my daughter too. And so, one of the things that I've noticed, which was, you know, the information age. We just went to the Billy Graham Library in Charlotte, and they talked about how Billy Graham appreciated technology and communication. That really launched his evangelistic message, you know, through TV and movies and so on. And that was a good start. Now I can be so spiritual I can't stand it. I can listen to a sermon. I can go here. I can listen to a sermon from Summit. I can listen to a sermon from Jay, all in the same day. You know, and it's just overwhelming. And I experienced the overwhelmingness of being able having access to computer knowledge didn't escape me when I was working for IBM and then later Cisco. They have a way of turning your 40-hour work week into, you know, 40 times 7. You know, because I could actually boot a controller from my desk at home. I could actually reboot the machine in the park. So there's no task left unturned. The other thing, when I talk about family, one of the things that's concerned is I think in some ways a lot of this stuff isolates us. Like I notice my grandsons, you know, I go over and I sit down and read them a book. Now they're obsessed with their games, or they're obsessed with text. Or, you know, some of my friends have gone home, have dinner, play with the kids a bit, and then they disappear into their study. They're on the computer, you know, and it's not horribly helpful. So that's just a warning, and I think it can be a bad thing.
You know, we faced that same problem years ago when TV started. Because I can remember, you know, my mother, she limited us to 30 minutes a day and in certain programs. Otherwise, I would have sat in front of the TV all day.
Yeah, exactly.
And I want to talk to each other. Respond to each other. So Collins is saying this was a big blessing, and Barry is saying watch out.
Yeah. Well, I'm not saying it's a total blessing. I'm just saying, for me personally, you know, it's benefited me quite a bit. You know, my career, I worked for IBM for 32 years. Obviously, that was a blessing. In terms of my fame, this presented me opportunities I wouldn't have had, or may not have had as easily anyway otherwise. But yeah, I know my kids have certainly spent far too much time in front of video games and TVs. And I understand the problems. Yeah, I'm not blind to them.
Let me say something about Dee's presentation because I don't want you to miss it. I heard a talk years ago, I can't even remember who it was now, saying that all these social networks and blogs and things on the computers are
community without intimacy. And I agree with that. I think if you look at a lot of these social networks, that, you know, I'm at the restaurant eating, or I got up this morning, couldn't decide what to wear. Yeah. That's not important stuff. But I think what you don't want to miss is that Dee went and met these people. And so there was intimacy there. But the computer can carry only so far with that relationship. You've got to step out beyond that and pursue that relationship with a face-to-face encounter. And I think that's, to me, I don't want us to miss that. I think that's important.
So I'm Bill, and Darlene's husband. When we came to them and actually met the men who were baptized, they already knew each other. It was that they hadn't seen each other. So there was intimacy by repeated connection. Virtually all of it was in this words environment. But through the exchange of words over protracted periods of time, they simply understood, they actually were never physically with each other, but they were at that point physically, when they met each other, they said, they talked to each other as if they had known each other for many years. So it's an interesting relationship that forms. It's not identical to Chaz's point to being physically meeting and repeatedly over the coffee, but there is intimacy there.
What aspect?
You think of the movie I've Got
Mail. I remember my oldest daughter was a missionary in China for 2 years teaching English. And at that time, the only possibility for communicating was a telephone, and that was, you know, San Lin San, that's supposed to be 303, 203. And I learned to say that, and the Chinese operator, you know, the crazy Americans, they finally figured out which room it was, and so when they heard this funny sound, they knew them. But now, she's in a position, she's an executive director of this World Student Christian Federation, and it's all about connecting people groups. Just, you know, some, you know, different levels. But anyway, she's all over the world, and Facebook is wonderful. Because we can actually, she, you know, when something happens, like she was in Cairo when they had that uprising. So we were glad to see her. You know, so she put stuff on that. So it was a wonderful thing. And then when we could FaceTime or Skype, it wasn't as intimate as being there, but it's a lot more than just text. So anyway.
I remember in World War II, your relative in Europe or in Southeast Asia or out in the Pacific, you could send a little V-mail, little blue piece of paper that got photographed, and then the reels of microfilm would transported by airplane, and you might get a 4-week turnaround. Mm-hmm. When my son-in-law was in Iraq, he talked every day on Skype to his family in England. Mm-hmm. And that's a big difference in terms of knowing what's going on with your loved one far away.
Well, Fred, you bring up an interesting point about the technology. I'm a stamp collector. And the reason why they microfilm that V card was the weight.
Yeah, sure.
It was, if you sent the actual cards, it was tonnage worth of weight. Uh-huh. They could microfilm it, and it was much, much less weight, and very much, much easier to transport. So that was just a sideline of the advance in technology.
Notice the technology has been in this church a long time. Even before it moved, this was the church of the overhead projector.
Address overload. Because that's the one thing I find from this.
you address.
No, no.
Well, how do you get overloaded,
Hank? Well, you just spend your whole life in the internet.
Well, you don't have to sign on.
That's right. No, I know. Just like that TV long down ago.
So, Arlene, I have a question I'd like you to answer. It seems to me one big difference has been you see things like United Breaks Guitars, where some big company has done something awful, and it used to be there was nothing you could do really to get back at them and let everybody know how awful they've been behaving. But it seems like your blog is showing that that's no longer quite the case. Could you comment?
Because of the issues that we discuss on our blog, we often hear about problems in churches. And I'll give you one example. There is a very well-known pastor who appears to have used $200,000 of church money to buy his way onto the New York Times bestseller list. This actually has swept. The Wall Street Journal has written about it. And so forth. Well, this all started because a few people on the blog, on our blog and a few others said, there's something wrong at my church. And I tried to discuss it, and I was marginalized and basically told I was causing disunity. And a couple of professors that I've become friendly with, Dr. Warren Throckmorton at Grove City College and Dr. James Duncan at Anderson University started reading my blog, and they began to write, and using their own unique insights into communications and so forth, started actually doing exposés on these things that were going on. And what's happening is some of these things that were kept very quiet over time are now becoming, people are becoming more and more aware. And let me tell you that it is not the exposure of the New York Times bestseller list is what it does to people inside the church and what it does to people outside the church. Our blog now has been quoted on Salon and Slate and Huffington Post because people will come onto our blog and say, do you know what's going on? And the funny thing about it is, people who are anonymous will tell the truth. And within anonymity, we begin to share things that we've been very afraid to share before. And so that's probably the best I can do with that.
Notice that anonymity protects lies as well.
Yes.
This is a two-edged sword, as so many of these things are. But many, many people whose behavior may have been bad, many Christians, when they thought only God was looking, behaved better when a whole lot of other people are looking. And that's an effect we are seeing.
Which actually brings one to the question. I turned on the computer this morning to find out what time it was. And unfortunately, it was time to leave, so I didn't get to read the article. But in the computer today, there was an article that MIT has done a study and has shown that just in the last 2 years, there's been a very drastic reduction, and I don't know how truthful these things are, in people believing in Christ in the internet, and they for the first time claim to show a connection between the use of the internet and a loss in religious faith. And like I said, I just glanced at the top of it because we had to leave, but I thought, oh my goodness. And they quoted an 8% difference in the last 2 years. So I don't know how, which was interesting. And as a question then, as far as one's religious belief, obviously if you are very much involved in, then it has very positive aspects, but do you think or how would it influence those that are, don't know what to think about it? Would they be likely to leave? Or?
Well, I remember reading an article about Josh. things they claimed was the belief that absolute truth has declined dramatically over the last several years. And they're really into the internet and the availability of atheists, agnostics, and others to put all kinds of information out there in front of people. Whether that's true, I don't know, but that's, you know, again, statistics can be misleading.
Exactly.
I don't know, but it wouldn't surprise me either.
Yeah. It's trash in, trash out. You know, how many of you have gotten an email about some story and it turned out it wasn't true?
Yeah.
We've all had that. And so I think you have to look at the information and investigate. And I think a lot of people don't do that. They just, whatever's on the internet, they accept the truth. And there's a lot of falsehoods on the internet.
Yeah, David and Beth Dulles were former missionaries, Alaska, Europe, and Congo. And we have two children, one who worked with Wycliffe for over 20 years, another who is right now in a very sensitive work in Central Asia, and the computer has totally revolutionized Wycliffe translation work with nationals all over the world. They have a goal of trying to complete the task by 2025, and it looks like it just might be in reach. And it's all because of the computer. Our son is doing Bible studies on Skype with individuals all over the world speaking that same language, which I can't mention. However, it is leading people to Christ, and he, as I speak, he is right now in California with one of these individuals who found the Lord. We support Dale Potter. I can't say where he is, but he is a computer whiz who is actually getting the scripture into different languages all over Central Asia. There are thousands of hits every day. This is big. I mean, it's exciting, and we're right in the middle of it. Can't really talk about it the way we want to, but it's exciting.
Yeah, in addition to that, they've got all these Bibles that are held up at the border that they can't get over, but they can take these little cards with the whole Bible on it over in his pocket.
Right, it's going on, and big time.
I'll get Bill to next, but I'll remark that when the 360s came out, I was real proud one day when I saw that one of the early models was being used for Bible translation by Wycliffe. And the next week I was in Grand Central Station and one of the same models was making horoscopes.
I just have a question for Dee. Could you expand on the nuns and the outreach to the nuns?
The Time magazine did a cover article, and you'll be hearing, you've probably heard about it. They call them the nuns, N-O-N-E-S. These are people who now no longer have a religious affiliation. I started looking into that, and in fact, we found that about 16.5 million of those supposed nuns have only left their religious affiliation, not their faith. These are people who have been hurt by the church and hurt in a number of ways. And so we became so concerned about this, we were seeing it on our blog. We started an e-church with Wade Burleson, who is a pastor in Oklahoma. And what it is we call it kind of like a halfway house. And we post Wade's sermons on it. We post some music, and we post some prayers. And we also allow for discussion under that post. And it is our way of saying, yes, we know the churches have hurt you. But there's value there in Jesus. Let's bring you back to seeing the good part of the faith. And that e-church has been startling. It startles me how many people go on that. And we keep it up all week. People can check in whenever they want. So anyway, that's our way of reaching what we think are the nuns that are still the faithful but don't want to step foot in a church because of pain.
Stand up.
Okay. Yeah, one thing about the issue with atheists and stuff like that, one thing the internet does is it makes it possible to access information freely, at least at this point in time. And one of the things that has happened is that the arguments against Christianity or the issues that exist are publicly available. And one of the things that the church has unfortunately done in the past, we can see it with Galileo, we can see it with other things, is that when reality is brought to light, a lot of times the church wants to hide behind orthodoxy rather than address the issue straightforwardly in upfront. And what the internet, I think, if we don't want to see people falling away from the faith because of the internet, as a church, we're going to have to honestly deal with the issues that are being raised. We can't just say, you shouldn't believe that, or you shouldn't listen to that. It's out there in front of everyone. Anyone can look at it any time. We have to come up with a response that makes sense, that's logical, and that puts forward the faith. And we can do that on the internet with just as much power as the new atheists are presenting their case. Mm-hmm. But we have to do it. We can't just hide behind, you shouldn't do that, or you shouldn't do this. We have to come and bring it forward.
There are some difficulties with that. I know I've had some exchanges on the internet, on Facebook with some friends involving some issues, and at a certain point, it gets to be, they won't listen to anything you say. I don't care how logical the argument is or anything. It's just because of, and one person, particular circumstances in his life that turned him off against God so much, I don't think there's anything I could say other than just be there for him and listen to him.
Right. An example of what you were saying is, the controversy about the Big Bang Theory. Not to go into it, but it's an important deal. And you can find out about that. You can go back and get the writings of George Lemaître, who was the inventor of the Big Bang Theory, and all the collaborators, and really learn about it. So, good point.
The Big Bang Theory says, in the beginning there was light.
Yeah.
And everything else came from the light.
I'm at a liberal arts school in the Deep South, so it's a very interesting combination of very people from very conservative backgrounds coming into a place that's not real liberal but has a lot of exchange of information. And a lot of my friends, I've noticed that as they start to encounter these new ideas, they realize that in a lot of ways they've been lied to their whole lives as far as what's real and what people who aren't Christians act like and stuff like that. They run into people who are atheists who are kinder to them than their pastors have been. And they become very, very disillusioned with their own church, and they don't realize that that's not the way every Christian is. And a lot of my friends are starting to search, and they're leaving the faith, and I get the feeling that as people start to realize what's really going on, they'll leave the faith, but if they are really searching, they'll find people who love them, and they'll eventually come back. But we'll see, I guess. They're not old enough yet for me to find out.
I'd like to ask each of you to briefly address Dr. Brooks' last question. How would a Christian approach the internet differently from a moral, secular person?
The whole area of containment and restraint and boundaries is a big one. And you can, it's disturbing to hear. I've heard the statistic that the average age for a young person, you know, boy or girl, encountering hardcore pornography is 10 with a click on that. And in a long time, it finds them. And so I would, if I'm a Christian parent, I would be sure to have foolproof, what do you call them?
Firewall
and that stuff, because it's, but you know, they can go over to their friend's house too. So yeah, I think a lot of it comes down to, you know, guarding your own behavior, and then, you know, really teaching your children that some boundaries. You just have to be aware of these boundaries and be connected with Jesus, frankly.
And the church has for millennia taught that one of the seven deadly sins is gluttony. And that has to do with restraint. And we have to learn it, and we have to apply discipline to it, regardless of whether the gluttony is intellectual or internet or real show enough food or what.
And I'd also really emphasize the importance of relationships with other Christians. I can't emphasize that enough. I mean, you know, someone mentioned that overload, and it is easy to get on a computer, especially if you're working, even if you're not really, and you lose touch with people, real one-on-one relationships. And you have to make an effort to maintain those relationships, not just the church, but outside. I mean, for example, I meet with two guys regularly every Wednesday morning, part of some other groups here and there, and you have to have these accountability relationships, you know, be honest with each other. And you can't do it alone. Absolutely not do it alone.
C.S. Lewis said, you have never met a mere mortal. And of course, he's talking about all of us are immortal souls. And the thing that I do every day is that each comment that comes into me isn't some words on a page. It's a person. It's somebody who is struggling, somebody who has reached out because this blog deals with abuse. And I have to remind myself of that every day, that this is a real dear person, dearly loved by God. And that's one of the reasons when somebody asks us to pray for them, I will often stick the prayer request on the front page of our blog and say, please pray for Sophie who's struggling right now. Because those people matter to me. And their souls are important to God. And I want to be God's love to these people who many of them have not been asked to.
Dr. Brooks, how do you answer your own question?
Well, I think just dealing with the question we just dealt with about overload and about how do I keep myself from being involved, spending too much of my time on this, and it was the same problem with television. It's the same problem with work. The work habit, unlike the drink habit, cannot be solved by total abstinence. And consequently, one has to deal with moderation, and moderation is much harder than abstinence in any of these things. So,
to that point, Dr. Brooks, I think it's really hard with employers these days, because now that we can work 24/7 and anywhere in the world, they expect us to work that hard. And, I mean, you wouldn't believe the number of students who will email me in the middle of the night, and they're really angry if I have not responded to them. Yeah. You know, even within 12 hours, say I get up at early in the morning, I have class all morning, maybe I have a meeting, you know, after lunch before I get back to their email, but they're really angry about response time not being instant. So I just think there's this ramping up of expectations of how much we have to work.
and how around the clock we have to work. And then we're reminded that, well, there's 100 people that'll take your job if you don't want it. So, I really struggle with this overly issue.
Well, one of my colleagues puts in every one of his syllabi that he will be available on email up until so-and-so, and he doesn't guarantee response faster than so-and-so.
Controlling
expectations. Yeah.
It would be very interesting to, this is not just a comment, that the majority of the world really are face-to-face communities. Very much so, very communal. It would be interesting to see how internet or how this affects the social fabric of those majority worlds. And I think in our, we are face to face, but we're more individualized. In some ways, the internet does, even though there's a bit of intimacy there, I think there's a lot of disconnection as well. And if you want to disconnect, you can do that through internet. And so I just don't know what the implications are going to be even for the missionary movement across the world.
For cultures. Yeah. For cultures.
Yeah.
We had a student, I recall, who would pass me on the steps. He would go up to the third floor and then send me an email. he was disturbed in other ways, too. But yes, this is a question I've put up here. What kinds of communication foster health and relationships? This is one of Jim's questions that he thinks is worthwhile to talk about. All right. Another one that comes up for those of us in the robotics and virtual reality business is, with respect to robotics, how much of human function can be taken over by machines? And the answer is a whole lot and more. Okay. And the other question is, how much of human experience can be simulated? And so for training emergency crews, for example, we can, as training people in military situations, simulation can, A, be much more effective in training because you can get more done in the same amount of time, and it costs less, and with military training, nobody gets hurt. And that's a big factor. But, all right, now, how much of human experience can you replicate with technology? And when you've done it, one of the effects of every revolution, this started with the Industrial Revolution most conspicuously, but it probably was also true when people started planting wheat instead of just hunting animals, was it separated the haves from the have-nots. And so when wheat planting came in, lo and behold, if you had good land, you got rich, and if you had poor land, you got poorer, and became a servant for the person who had the good land. So there's always been the immediate effect of a revolution has been an economic separation. This was discussed in the newspaper, or The Economist, I think, this week. Is that a consequence? We're seeing it every day. We're seeing this mass of essentially unemployable people get larger, and employable people doing very well indeed, thank you. And we're going to see more of that. But notice the same thing happened with the tractor. Yes.
I think today computers can look at scripture and use Strong's numbers and do things like that. Do you foresee computers looking at scripture and making comments about what's a metaphor and what you can take literally and more complex issues like that?
Well, most of the authorship studies have been done by computer. When I was a graduate student, there was an Episcopal priest who was building a concordance of the RSV. There had not been a concordance for the RSV, and it was the first popular alternative translation to the King James in the United States. And so, on this UNIVAC 1, he was busy and did make a concordance. So, as David points out, this powerfully aids any kind of linguistic studies, good, bad, and indifferent. And
you will see more computer-generated arguments that the scripture is not valid. You will see more computer-generated cases that illuminate what the truth is. Okay.
Dr. Brooks, would you comment on the coming, I think there's probably a coming revolution in terms of the human-computer interface. Because there's research being done where they're actually reading the thoughts of people and interpreting, the computers are interpreting what's going on. There's also...
with mighty low accuracy.
There's research on that. So I'm wondering if we're not getting ready to face another revolution in terms of the human-computer interface.
Well, one we're already seeing is gesture interaction.
Could you repeat the question?
The question is, there going to be a revolution in the human-computer interface? And the answer is, we are already seeing one. And when people talk to each other, they wave their arms. They move their hands. They move their heads. And we're going to see that when you interact with a computer, too. Okay? That will be a way of expressing yourself. And they are running experiments at reading what people are thinking. This is a very the cheap technology doesn't work very well, and the very expensive one doesn't tell you very much. But it's coming. All right, it's coming. The ability to tell, and already they can, from computers can, from facial analysis of what's on your face, tell what your emotions are, and that's been reported in the last year or so. So thank you very much for your action.
I'm sorry that we're out of time.